Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'd like to welcome our live audience here in San Francisco and our online and radio audiences. Tonight we have Steve Bochtinger coming back for third or fourth time to talk on this time on Mercy and Mozart's Menuetto Allegretto. Thought I'd say a little bit about how we met. We're both lawyers, and we met as lawyers 10, 15 years ago. I think we were introduced by a professor. You had a professor. Yeah, I was a partner with a man who had been his professor in law school. And we just got introduced, and we could see right away that we weren't the average lawyer, and so we eventually found out that he's a musician and I'm a writer, and we've been friends ever since. So, Steve, just great on both the ideas and the performance, and we've had a lot of fun with the intellectual insight into the music in addition to the absolutely wonderful performances of Mozart. So, without further ado, Steve Bochtinger.
Thank you, George. So this is the third in a series of talks here about how instrumental music can convey philosophical ideas. And in this presentation, I will try to demonstrate how Mozart explores Enlightenment ideas about transgression, punishment, forgiveness, and mercy in the minuet of his great G minor viola quintet written in 1787. A minuet is often found in symphonic works. It's usually the second or third movement in a symphony. You'll also hear it in quartets of Mozart, Haydn, early Beethoven. The standard model for a minuet to be used in a performance is threefold. There are three sections. It starts with the minuet, and then there's a section called a trio, which had its origination because it was played by three instruments, two bassoons and a lower instrument usually. And then the minuet is repeated. And each one of these three sections has two parts which are called strains, and each of those parts is repeated. The allegretto refers to the tempo marking, and it's to indicate that it's to be played faster than the normal dance minuet. So just to give you a taste, what we're going to do is start by playing the first section, the minuet section of this piece, without the repeats, and then we'll take it apart and put it back together again. Repentance and forgiveness are central issues in all six of the operas that Mozart wrote when he was in Vienna. Before we get to those, I'd like to introduce my fellow musicians, Anna Washburn on violin, Midori Nakayama on violin, Luella Hasbun on cello, and Oscar Hasbun on viola. So I'm going to give you a few examples. This has been commented on by many of Mozart's biographers. His first truly great opera, The Marriage of Figaro, has its dramatic climax near the end of the opera when the countess, who's been cheated on by her husband, the count, finally, through a series of very complicated plots, traps him into admitting that he's been a philanderer, and he begs for her forgiveness. And only then do we have the conclusion of the opera where she forgives him and they live on to a what's probably a very unhappy marriage. His next opera, Don Giovanni, has a very famous scene at the end of the opera where the Don Giovanni has killed the commendatore and has invited him back to visit him in his guise as a statue. And so the statue of this murdered leader of the community comes back and takes Don Giovanni's hand and demands that he repent for his sins. And Don Giovanni refuses and is dragged down to hell. And so here's an example of what happens when you don't repent. The next opera, Così fan tutte, also involves trickery and then forgiveness. These two soldiers make a bet with this old philosopher that their fiancés will always be faithful, and they come back disguised as Albanians. Each one tries to seduce the other's fiancé, and to their horror, they are successful. And so at the climax of the opera, there's a lot of forgiving to be done, both by the men for their fiancé's infidelity and by the women for their fiancé's trickery. And finally, Mozart's very last opera, the La Commedia di Tito, actually has mercy in the title, the clemency of Titus, the mercy of Titus. In this opera, the Roman emperor is confronted with the fact that his most beloved, loyal subject, a young man named Testo, has been involved in a plot to assassinate him. And the plot is revealed, and at the end he decides, well, what good is it to be emperor if we can't exercise mercy and forgiveness, and all is forgiven? That's a little hard to believe on a Roman emperor, but that shows you why this the extremes that people went to make these points. And so why was mercy such a big issue in all of these operas? It was important to Mozart. It was important to the patrons who commissioned these big operas. It was important to his audiences. And I think the reason is that this was what we call the late Enlightenment. We're talking about the late 1780s in Austria, where the whole world is being turned upside down. When this quintet was written, it was April of 1787, just 2 years before the French Revolution. The Constitutional Convention had just been convened to iron out these new ideas and form a new nation under which we're still living. So we're still living in the aura of the decisions that were made way back when. People were debating the relationship between rulers and subjects, between nobility members and their servants, between men and women. And from a theological perspective, people were debating, is there a God? And if there is a God, is God merciful? And this was the subject of the great debate between Leibniz and Voltaire. And we all read Candide sometime in college, and that was Voltaire making fun of Leibniz's doctrine that everything is always for the best in this best of all possible worlds. In Germany, there was the issue of religious toleration, both under Frederick the Great in Prussia and in Austria under Joseph II, who had just taken over in 1780 or 1781. And he was Mozart's patron, and he had acquired lots of new territories with people of different religions. Austria was a Catholic country. Mozart was brought up as a Catholic, but they had acquired a new land in Galicia, which had many Jews, and there were Protestants, and people had very clear recollection of the devastation of the 30 Years' War, which had torn Germany apart, And so people were looking for ways to respect other people who had different views, even though their religion taught them that they were sinners and were all going to hell. So this became a major issue. And then on a broader philosophical issue and political issue, there was a struggle between the church and the state, and the church was claiming that the only route to heaven was to take the sacraments from a licensed priest on your deathbed, and if you didn't do that and a couple other things, your soul was not in for a good future. And so there was a major debate, and in fact, Mozart happened to be in Paris, visiting Paris at the age of 22 in 1778 when Voltaire came out of exile from Switzerland and made this triumphant return to Paris, and he had to figure out how to get the final sacraments from the church without disavowing all of his beliefs that he had and philosophy, and somehow he, through very clever wiles, he was a trained lawyer, I understand, he was able to get the final sacrament, and Mozart was there. It ruined his visit to Paris, and he went home back to Salzburg without anything to show for it because the whole scene was dominated by Voltaire. So we're going to try to show how a minuet by Mozart expressed a lot of these ideas. So let's start with what is a minuet. A minuet was an aristocratic dance of the French court. It was very popular during the time of Louis XIV. It was very stylized. People danced with very tiny steps, and the word minuet comes from the same root as the word minuscule, tiny, tiny steps. It was outdated by the 1780s and would soon be replaced by other dances, and most prominently by the scherzo, which Haydn and Beethoven started using in their symphonies. So just to give you an idea of what a traditional minuet sounds like, we're going to hear the minuet from Don Giovanni, which Mozart wrote just a few months after he wrote the quintet we'll be speaking about in a few minutes. Now, you all recognize that piece, and you know why? Because your parents forced you to take piano lessons. And if you got beyond just a few piano lessons, you were forced to learn this piece. That was an idealized minuet based on the French tradition. Mozart wrote that minuet for the express purpose of destroying it. And your piano teacher probably didn't tell you that. In Don Giovanni, Don Giovanni is about to be accosted by a group of five people that he's managed to humiliate, offend, and otherwise assault just that very morning. And they come in masks, and he is having a big dinner. And he welcomes them into the dinner, and he has the musicians play this minuet, and he gets two of the masked characters to dance, and those two happen to be the aristocrats, Donna Anna and Don Ottavio. Donna Anna is the one whose father was murdered and who Don Giovanni tried to sexually assault earlier that day. So they symbolize the aristocracy. They've come to seek revenge on Don Giovanni. He is, meanwhile, trying to seduce a peasant girl named Zerlina and has them dance this minuet in order to distract them while he goes about his seduction scene. While this quartet is playing this minuet that you just heard, a second orchestra on the stage starts playing another dance. It's a German dance in a different meter. And Don Giovanni's servant, Leporello, takes up with Zerlina's fiancé, Mazzetto, and starts trying to dance with him in 3/8 time. And then a third orchestra appears on stage, and Don Giovanni starts dancing with Zerlina. And this is in a 2/4 time. So he's got three different dances, three different orchestras, three different meters, all synchronized so that it all blends together just perfectly, but only for a couple of seconds. And then it all falls apart. Zerlina starts screaming that Don Giovanni is accosting her. People start yelling, and chaos ensues. And so the symbolism of this, of course, is that the aristocracy is awaiting its downfall, and the aristocracy is symbolized by this minuet that we just heard and that our piano teachers never told us about. And something similar happens in this G minor quintet. There's been a long debate about whether instrumental music can have any philosophical meaning or any meaning outside of the music itself. There was a movement started in Germany in the 1800s. It lasted for over 100 years, and people were on both sides of the debate were putting forth the idea that the music of Mozart, Haydn, and early Beethoven was what they called absolute music. And it was pure absolute music. It had no meaning outside of itself, no extra musical meaning. It just was, and it was not proper to attribute any social, philosophical, cultural, or political meaning to it. And different sides of the debate was really over whether absolute music was good or whether it was not as good as what they called program music, which was music that had an actual text. So for 100 years, people didn't talk about what was the meaning of music, and it was considered not very intellectually respectable to do that. And so if you went to college and studied music, all you would get would be the relationship of the tonalities, the different rhythms, comments between one part of the piece and another part of the piece, but no one would get into the other thing. That's been that's broken down over the past generation, and beginning in around 1970, musicologists have begun to look at the fact that music arises in a particular cultural context, and it may express something more than itself. And in particular, they've been looking at the idea that classical music, even instrumental music, has what they call narrativity. That there's a beginning, and there's characters, and there's adventures, and there's confrontations, and it's a story. And so what I've been doing is trying to explore what stories are being told in this music, and whether the stories can be thought of as parables, which have some kind of symbolic meaning. So my theory of this minuet is that it's the story of a confrontation that occurs at the scene of the pearly gates. And it's a confrontation between the spirit of a hero and God over the salvation of the hero's soul. And I'm going to give you the evidence that I think supports this argument. There are some biographical reasons. At the time he wrote this piece, Mozart was obsessed with the possibility of his own death. He was 31 years old, and he was seriously questioning everything, not just his religion, but the meaning of life and every aspect of what he stood for. He wrote a famous letter to his father on April 4th, 1787. His father was seriously ill, and Mozart had just gotten the news. He wrote to his father that he was thinking a lot about death. One of his very closest friends had just died, and he was a friend of Mozart's age, someone he'd made music with and loved very much. And Mozart said he never goes to bed at night without thinking that that he may not wake up the next day. And he told his father that he hoped he got better, but if not, not to worry. Death is our best friend, and it's the key to our happiness. So that has been taken by Mozart's biographers as Mozart's view on these things. The idea that death is the key to our happiness came right out of a book by Moses Mendelssohn, who was an Enlightenment philosopher, and Mozart knew Mendelssohn's family and happened to own the book in which Mendelssohn famously expressed these very thoughts about the immortality of the soul. The reason, apart from the fact that Mozart was thinking and writing about death, was that if my analysis of the first movement was correct, the hero dies at the end of the first movement, and there's three movements to go. So what can happen to the hero after his death? Well, we have to deal with what happens to his soul. So that would be the next event in the narrative. So what I'd like to do now is, and you probably remember this from the lecture I gave 3 years ago, but what I'd like to do is play the very end of the first movement so you can hear what immediately precedes this minuet. And I want you to listen to the chromatics, the descending chromatic scale in the first violin. A chromatic is a series of notes that are one half step apart, and a descending chromatic is a scale, a chromatic scale that goes down. This has been accepted for hundreds of years as the symbol of somebody dying. So our hero has died, and his soul is now wondering what's going to become of it. And the minuet is announced by a theme, which in the first movement is identified with the angel of death. So the angel of death comes to the hero and summons him and tells him he's going to die and makes a statement to the hero. And this is the second theme of the first movement, which the audience would have had in its mind when it hears the minuet. And I'll tell you why these two tie together in just a second. Play the very beginning of the minuet and see if you can remember or figure out where this tune comes from. Let's just hear the first violin. Right, now that's the end of the Angel of Death theme. Play it again. Now play the tune for the minuet. That's what's called a perfect authentic cadence. And it's obviously the same tune, and that tune appears throughout all five movements of this quintet. The thing about a perfect authentic cadence, first, the definition of it, it's a cadence is the ending of a phrase. A perfect authentic cadence is a cadence that ends on the tonic, which is the basic chord of the whole piece, with the top line ending on the main note of that scale in which the key is. So it's the final word. And so the Angel of Death leaves no room for argument that he or she means business. And similarly, when we hear this theme at the beginning, that's the end of it. The final determination has been made. Now, the same sequence of notes later appears in the Mozart Requiem in the Dies Irae movement. The Requiem was the Mass of the Dead. We all know that story. Mozart was secretly commissioned to write a Requiem, and it was he never actually finished it, but he did finish the Dies Irae movement. The text of Dies Irae reads, "Day of wrath, day of anger will dissolve the world in ashes. Great trembling there will be when the judge is seated to examine all things closely." Now, the motif that we just heard accompanies the text of the Dies Irae in two places. One is where the words, "when the judge is seated," and also "to examine all things closely." So this invokes... Now, Mozart hadn't written it yet, but somehow this theme inspired him both to write this quintet and to write "when the judge is seated to examine all things closely." And a later verse of the Dies Irae, when therefore the judge will sit, whatever hides will appear, nothing will remain unpunished. So that's one clue that Mozart was thinking of the fate of the soul when he composed this piece. We also know that he was preparing to write Don Giovanni. He had just come back from Prague and was waiting for his libretto and thinking about Don Giovanni. Don Giovanni is the only one of Mozart's mature operas, maybe one of his only operas, in which someone on stage dies. And in fact, two people die. First, the commendatore dies when Don Giovanni murders him. And then Don Giovanni dies when the statue of the commendatore comes back and drags him down to hell. And each time, the orchestra plays a descending chromatic scale to accompany the death of that character. So that's further evidence that Mozart deliberately used this chromatic scale to symbolize a character's death. We also have several examples of descending scales in this minuet, particularly at the beginning of the second strain. You'll hear it in the first violin. You'll also hear it in the cello and the first viola. It's all over the place. Another piece of evidence relates to that scene in the first act of Don Giovanni, in which a quintet of accusers comes to his party, calling for him to be struck by a thunderbolt. They say, "Odo il tuon dello vendetto." And vendetto means revenge. That's an English word, vendetta. And when they say that, we hear precisely the same phrase in an authentic, perfect cadence. It can be translated, "hear the thunder of revenge." That's a literal translation. There's a famous translation by W.H. Auden. He translates it as, "mark the voice of wrath eternal, mortal vengeance armed by heaven soon must fall upon your head." So when we come to this quintet, this minuet, we hear the opening phrase, which says it all, the final word, and then we have a plea for mercy in the rhythm of the minuet. And then that plea for mercy is cut off by a thunderbolt. And the thunderbolt is a huge, sudden chord by all five strings, playing on all the strings. It's as loud as possible. And it just interrupts, it cuts off the supplicant pleading for mercy on his soul. Then the supplicant tries again with two pairs of slurred notes. Now, a pair of slurred notes was commonly understood to represent a sigh. We can find examples of that throughout Mozart's operas as well. So we have a sigh, and then it's more like a whimper. And that's cut off by another thunderbolt. Each of these thunderbolts is a chord which we call a diminished seventh. A diminished seventh is a very dissonant chord. It's just a stack of minor thirds piled one on top of each other. And Mozart typically used that represent dissonant things that people wouldn't want to hear about. For example, we hear three diminished seventh chords when the angel of death finally has the last word in the first movement of this piece. And we also have three diminished seventh chords in Don Giovanni when Don Giovanni is striking the commendatory to death. There are three strikes, and three strikes also correspond to three strikes in the ritual ceremony in which Mozart was initiated into the Freemasons as a master mason just 2 years earlier. And he had witnessed this many times. And in the ceremony, the candidate is struck somewhat forcefully on the head once and then twice and then the third time more forcefully, and the candidate drops to the ground and undergoes a ritual burial and resurrection. So there's this ritual murder of the candidate. As we know, Mozart was very involved with the Freemasons. And if you're a Freemason, as in baseball, it's three strikes and you're out. So in this case, we hear two thunderbolts in the first strain and three thunderbolts in the second strain. That's the last of the thunderbolts and the last of our hero. And after that, we just have the most pathetic, desolate, a tune that's played in the first violin and then in the second violin. One of Einstein's biographers, his name is Alfred Einstein, wrote that this passage is reminiscent of the passage in the New Testament where Jesus goes to the Garden of Gethsemane, where he's retreated after the Last Supper to contemplate his fate. And he says to God, not as I will, but as you will. And that's the feeling that this, these poor violins have to express. And then just at that moment in the quintet, a ray of light appears. And we come to the trio. And the same theme that ends the minuet appears in G major instead of G minor. And it's like it's like a breath of fresh air and a ray of hope, and that becomes the theme for the entire trio. First, it's played by the first violin, then it's taken up as a love duet between the violas. And whenever you hear two characters in an opera singing in close harmony, as these violas do, it's a plea. It's a symbol of love. Not only romantic love, but of sacred love. And we find that in another one of Mozart's operas, The Abduction from the Seraglio, where we have these two characters are about to be executed by the Pasha for a jailbreak. And he leaves them to contemplate their fate. And he hears them singing this duet, and it just soars. And they decide that they're happy, that they have the privilege of dying together, and they will be happy in heaven. And he is so moved by this that he grants them clemency and gives them their liberty. And so you'll hear that in the violas. So what I'd like to hear now is the end of the minuet section and the beginning of the trio section, so you can hear how this this theme morphs from a theme of despair to a theme of bright light. last few bars of the minuet, first few bars of the trio section. But the tragedy of the minuet is inherent in its ternary form, because after this beautiful trio, we have to go back to the desolation of the minuet. And the hero's fate is once again in the hand of God, and we don't really know whether God has heard the prayers or the love, because it ends on a note of despair. And by these interruptions, and one thing I neglected to mention is that not only do we have an interruption, but the tempo changes when these big thunderbolts come, and it goes from a 3-4 dance to a martial 2-4. It's a device called a hemiola, which is not a blood disease. It's a musicological term. And where we hear, instead of two bars of three beats each, we have two bars of three pairs of two beats. And so we have, it's more of a martial tone. And so every time there's an interruption, it's like God reminding the supplicant that this is not a dance. We're not equals. We don't dance together. It's not a minuet. It's a march, and I'm calling the tune. And this is what Mozart is expressing through this this change of tempo and these thunderbolts. He's saying that God or nature, and that was Spinoza's phrase, God or nature is what's in charge and demands absolute submission from humans. And this is quite a contrast to his letter that he wrote at the same time, saying that death is our best friend and the key to our happiness. So we are going to play the entire movement for you now. Minuet and trio, and then minuet again. I think we have time for a few questions.
Would you say that this thank you so much. Would you say that this same critique then could follow in modern music because of the descending that came to light, Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, and also the cadence? I am a very poor piano player, but that last note when you play it is absolute final, the final note.
My favorite example of the descending chromatic in modern music is in a classical piece by the Beatles, Eleanor Rigby. So if you listen to Eleanor Rigby, and even if you've never listened to the words, you'll know that Eleanor Rigby dies at the end, because in the main chorus, the second violin is playing a descending chromatic. So I don't know which of the Beatles or their arrangers thought of that, but it's in every Beatles arrangement. And you can find this descending chromatic in Dido and Aeneas of Purcell. It's repeated throughout the entire great last scene, Dido's Lament. It's at the very beginning of the Brahms Requiem. I've heard it's in Poulenc. I'm sure it's in Gershwin. It's kind of fun. You can play Where's Waldo with these sorts of things.
I'd like to remind our audience that they're listening to Steve Machtiger speaking on Mercy in Mozart, along with his quintet. So, other questions. We have a good 10, 15 minutes for questions. So if anybody else would like to ask questions, for some reason we only have one mic here today, you can kind of come up over here, and I'll hand out the mic to those who are ready to ask. Anybody like to ask another question? Okay, great.
Hi, Steve. So how is it that you have time in your life to do all of this? And when you're sitting listening to Mozart, reflecting and enjoying and so on, do these ideas just spring into your mind and it just drives you to find out all of this? Because I'm thinking, I used to just sit and enjoy listening to Mozart. Now I'm just going to analyze it.
Well, the reason that I have time is that my beautiful wife does all the cooking.
She's an expert, too. She spoke here at the Commonwealth Club on exactly that topic.
And I did not do any of the cooking when she did that. It's become, I blame George for this. When George first asked me to do a lecture, I told him I wanted to do one on the philosophy of the initial public offering, because that's my field. He said, no, I want to hear your quintet. So it's been an exploration, and I just get an incredible charge out of discovering these things that have been right there in earshot of all of us, that nobody has... I didn't find all... Some of these things you can find in the literature, but I don't... No one has ever... put together an analysis of Mozart the philosopher, and I think it's because of this taboo that the musicology departments had for 100 years. You just weren't allowed to look at this stuff. It was too subjective, and they were trying to build a science of musicology, and it's just a question of putting these things together. And as a lawyer, what I love to do is take seemingly unrelated facts. You're a lawyer, you know this, and you build chronologies. And so for every time I look at one of these things, I just try to put it all in chronological order, try to figure out what was going on in the world, in Mozart's life, what was he working on at different times. It was actually Albert Schweitzer who started writing about musical signs in the work of Bach, and Mozart discovered Bach in the early 1780s. And a lot of these things were written up by Albert Schweitzer, and you can find them in all the Bach cantatas. And so that was, and it's a very rich vein to explore. And the more, even every time I look at this piece, I find new things, and it's very exciting.
And we now have a second mic, and in order to avoid back, you can come back here and ask questions, and anybody would like to ask the next question. The abstract thing. Well, yeah.
I also am in awe of you guys. I compose music, but I've never had enough time to really master an instrument, so I really love it when I can hear it. I had a question on the notes at the end. When you did, you struck the string, and then there were like three rests, bum, 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 two rests. What was the meaning of that? Did I miss that? Just at the very end of the piece, yeah.
Well, that's the desolation theme, there's also the same hemiola. So even in death, the hero is marching to the tune of the universe. It's not a duet.
What were
Well, we'll play it. Well, we'll play it for you. It's just a cadence into G minor.
One of the things I think a lot of people are curious about Mozart, Steve, is you know, I mean, of course, from the movie Amadeus, in that he just had these pieces and just were completely formed in his head, and he just wrote them down smoothly without any mistakes. And how much truth is there to that movie imagery? Do you know?
Well, the movie is generally quite inaccurate. My favorite comment about Amadeus is this critic named Jim Schweda in L.A. who says, "It's a historically inaccurate, irresponsible movie that I've seen 36 times." but it's true that he did compose these pieces in his head. He would even say that he could be writing something out that he'd already mentally composed while composing something new in his head. So he could be writing something and composing a new piece at the same time. Oh. If you examine his manuscripts, they're very neat. He writes very quickly. There are very few mistakes. Part of the thrill of this is to try to explore the mind of one of history's greatest geniuses. People ask, well, did he really think about all these things? All these different clues and associations, were they deliberate, or did he just do it? We'll never know that. I suspect that his mind just worked on a different level from ours. But we can have glimpses into his genius through these associations, and the more you look at it, the more profound it is.
Yeah, like a great writer. I mean, they don't sit there and think of each illusion that they're using, but they're all in their minds. They already have all those illusions. They write, and then you can tell which ones they've used. So I'm sure it's fairly similar from that point of view. Next question. Anybody else have another question? Or does Mozart? Yeah, great.
I was wondering if you think that all music is accessible as narrative. Or is it based on the? Does there need to be an intention, or you know, could you riff on, you know, Weber and Schoenberg, any number of other people, and actually find a necessary narrative in the music?
As always, Jim Quinn asks a great question. At the most general level, all music is narrative. There have been studies of the brain which seem to be indicating that we process all information as narrative, even before language. There's a book I'm reading called The Literary Mind, which talks about how the brain works. But music is especially, it lends itself especially well to being interpreted as narrative. There's a beginning, there's a middle, there are events. There's nothing before it starts, and then music itself is nothing but vibrations in the air. And that's just a pretty simple metaphor for life itself. And then at the end, there are no more vibrations. And so I think particularly the music of the classical era and the sonata form, which appears somewhat in this minuet, but more clearly in the first movement, the sonata form ruled for about 150 years until Webern and Schoenberg, from the time of Mozart and Haydn in the, let's say, 1760s, all the way up into the early 20th century. And one of the reasons is it's based on theme one and theme two and their confrontation and the interaction between theme one and theme two. These are characters in a story. And then we have, that's the exposition introduces the characters, and then we have a development section where the hero goes out on a quest. This seems to tie in subliminally to the work of Jung and Joseph Campbell, and we have the hero's journey, and then the hero returns from his adventures, and things are with a new perspective, and theme two is now in the same key as theme one, and we have reconciliation, and then it's all tied together. So that's the narrative. Becomes more difficult with atonal music. And I think that's one reason why atonal music really never caught on beyond academia. It was an experiment that failed. And Leonard Bernstein has written that Stravinsky saved classical music by anchoring it back into tonality. You need some kind of anchor in a story, or there's no tension. It might be a narrative, but it's not a very interesting narrative. So the 12th tone and the serialists failed, I think, because they failed to recognize the narrativity of tonal music. Next time we'll play the third movement.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you.
Why don't you introduce?
I did introduce. Okay. Do you want me to introduce him again?
Just say who they were. I think everyone.
Okay, Anna Washburn and Midori Nakayama. Oscar and Luella Husband are colleagues from the Marin Symphony. We've been playing in Marin Symphony together for more years than we now care to admit, and they've been at both of our prior concerts here. And I thank them for. Good work.
And this is a good time to mention that in August, as those of you who are members of the Commonwealth Club know, we always have a theme for the month of lectures during August. And this year it's going to be Music Matters. So there'll be lots and lots of music this summer in August. And thank you very much for coming. It's another event of the Commonwealth Club in its 112th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much.